We're getting started up here momentarily. Thanks, everyone. And just so you know, we're going to go back in time a little bit, in the program, that is. And we're going to do the DNSSEC root key rollover presentations with Russ Mundy and Rick Lamb. So come on, get a seat at the table, and we'll start momentarily.
All right, folks, we're about to get started here. We may not have our cameras, so it's just the root key rollovers, so we'll forego the camera if we need to.
There is a camera. It's just not
Oh,
yes.
Okay.
There is a separate camera.
There is the camera running.
Right here. See this one?
Oh, yeah. Okay, in the room.
He's recording it separately.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, so if everybody could take their seat, we'll get going here for our afternoon session, which this is a reschedule of what was originally the morning session. This is a panel describing the recent ESSEC publication about the root key rollover. It is SAC 063. Ah, okay, so it's a scroll through. Okay.
I don't think it works. Let me see if it works to do this.
Oh, I can just do the scroll. Yeah. That's fine. No problem.
Yeah, you can see what it's like.
Yeah. Okay. So we have okay. Well, we're mostly on the screen. It only went one way. Okay, so I'll let Julie take care of moving it when we need to. So the ESSEC, for those that may not be familiar with it, is an advisory committee of ICANN for security and stability. And we, as a group, I'm a member of ESSEC, and there's several other members here in the room that happen to be here also. We issue advisories to the community. There is absolutely nothing binding about any of these advisories. They are truly advice, hopefully useful advice to the community. And so this is advice about the root key rollover itself. One of the points that we have identified that's part of the document when you read the details is this document does not provide any advice on the quantity or timing of when or how often you ought to do root key rollovers. It deals with topics that you need to think about as part and consider and plan for as part of Root Key rollovers. You can see the general overview there on this slide, which is the sections, really the sections that are in the report. It's not moving here.
Okay, you do it there.
Yeah, great. Yeah. Great. Even better. So we have five recommendations. And I won't read them verbatim, but I urge folks to download the report from the ICANN-SAC website and read them in detail, because in total it's about a, I think it's about a 40-page report. The recommendation section and executive summary section are less than 5 pages total. So if you want to read a little less, read exec summary and then read the recommendation section to get the high-level view. But recommendation one is really pointing at publicizing and working in conjunction with the community to make sure that it's as broad spread set of knowledge as possible that the root key rollover for the root zone is coming, and describe the mechanisms and the motivation why and what's going to happen, so it's not a surprise to people. Next. Next recommendation is that the ICANN staff, in coordination with the larger community, that they should create a collaborative test bed working with the community to have a facility and a way, not necessarily just in one place, but whatever the staff decides is the best way to approach it in the community, a way to test things relative to the rollover prior to doing the rollover. Again, part of what we've seen experience-wise, test before you do the DNSSEC piece for real. The third recommendation is dealing with developing and otherwise encouraging people to decide what breakage means with respect to a root key rollover, so we know in advance, first of all, what to look for, and secondly, that people have a much broader, consistent agreement as to what it means. Next, please. Fourth recommendation deals with developing procedures for rolling back to the current key if, for whatever reason, that becomes necessary. So this is something that, again, if hopefully it won't be needed, but if it does cause some significant problem, we want to be sure you can get back to the original key that's actually out there and in use now. And that needs to include procedural things as well as technical things. The fifth recommendation is really for collecting information and analyzing information related to the root key rollover itself, and looking at that data collection and analysis of the data to use for deciding the frequency and things to watch for in future KSK rollovers for the root zone. So that's it, right? Is there one more? Yeah, that's it. So those are the five recommendations in the SAC document. And I think in the interest of time, let me just ask Rick to go, and then we'll take questions after that if we could.
Okay, I need to share.
Hi, this is Rick Lamb. While Julie's getting that presentation up, I'll say one of the advantages of working in this community is that we get to see each other often, and we work closely together. So hopefully, I mean, you'll see my slides. They will should pretty much align with some of the recommendations. All right. So start with, we've been, and this is from the perspective not just of ICANN, but a little bit from the Root Zone design team. That's a team that was put together originally in designing the system that created the developed the architecture and the procedures, processes for the root zone itself. So we've been able to reinstantiate that group, and this includes VeriSign, NTI, U.S. Department of Commerce, and ourselves. And this is what we're doing. We're starting to plan and develop approach. You can read that as easy as I can, based on input that we've received. Next slide, please. So we're still in the very early stages. We met at the Berlin IETF, which I think was the end of July of this year, and at that point we had already gone through a had part of a public consultation process with the community that talked about the KSK rollover and what kind of interest the community had. And so we've been identifying research and testing and the kind of outreach that might be necessary in the communication. Next slide, please. Try to get to some of the meat of this, because I know we're techies here. Parameters, none of this is frozen in stone. But within that group, our discussions were that we're not going to do an algorithm roll for this first pass. We're not going to bite off way more than we can chew. An algorithm roll takes a lot more work. And we're not actually going to change key sizes either. So that's the conclusion we've reached. But we're looking for feedback. And if someone could make a really strong case for an elliptic curve cryptography, hey, job security for me. Keep going. All right. The mechanisms, of course, we're just going to publish the new trust anchor as early as we possibly can. I mean, before it even shows up in the root zone file, give people as much time as possible. When I say as early as possible, the kind of time frames we're looking at are like 6 months, sort of thing. We will also support 5011, with its revo capability. Next slide, please. And this is wonderful that the ESSAC report actually recommends this. We realized how important outreach was and communication was during the DNSSEC deployment. And so we're going to do that again. And that's very much a part of whatever plan that we come up with is going to be a pretty heavy outreach. Of course, we all know that the informal consultations are also very critical in this, where people feel free to tell us exactly what they think and what they think the right steps will be. Next slide, please. 5011 testing is one of the key things we worry about. Just a short refresher to those who don't know what 5011 is. It's a key rollover protocol, and it has as part of, was one of its states actually revoking the current key. What's important about that is that's the point of no return. So if you are implementing 5011 and you see a packet that says revoke or a key structure that says revoke, that key is no longer good. So we have to be very careful about how we do that, and we need to make sure that works. There will be a public test bed. This will run for many months and have engagement directly from the community. This last bullet's very important. Rolling the KSK, the biggest impact is going to be on the resolvers. So we're going to get up close and friendly with a lot of the large resolver operators and software vendors, i.e., Google and people like that, because they make up almost, some of them make 5% of the DNSSEC validations right now. So next slide, please. Response, thanks to some of the members in this room that actually pointed this out. There is some definite problems when you deal with IPv6 and UDP, and you start to increase the packet size due to the DNS key RR set, the record type in DNSSEC that actually has all the keys in it. That's definitely going to expand as we roll. You have to introduce the new key and the old key. There'll be double signatures. And no matter how much work we do to try to minimize that impact and minimize the packet sizes, we are likely to overrun that particular number. So there's going to be a lot of internal testing done with that before we do anything else. And, of course, there'll be a, as before with the root, there'll be our ears will be very wide open listening for any kind of issues that might be happening out there, as well as sensors. Thanks. Next slide. All right. Rollback. Yeah, this was something even before the ESSAC recommendations, everyone at the table is so afraid of, all right, well, what if we screw up, how can we do something? How can we roll back? And so this is very prominent in our design. As I said, there is a point in the 5011 protocol where a rollback is not possible. And so in those cases, we certainly would not be going back to publishing the old key. But what we've done, none of this is in stone. One of the theories, or one of the approaches that has been developed by some of our friends from Cure, actually, who formed part of the original KSK rollover design team, was that we could actually we could delay the reject state in 5011 till much later in the process. So we can we will have already rolled the key by then. The new key will already be in state in place. But should something at that point go haywire and people start calling up ICANN and throwing tomatoes at us more than they normally do, we can go back. So this is something critical. Next slide, please. Future rollovers, there's a lot of discussion about, you know, why don't we do this planning? Let's figure out the whole, let's come up with a plan for not only this roller, but all future rollovers. That's not what we're going to do. Since this is the very first rollover we're going to do, we're going to take this very conservatively, and we're going to learn from that first key rollover before we do anything else. If you looked at any of the comments from the public consultation period, there were people that thought we should roll this three times a year initially to really get this ingrained, and then others maybe they said there's no need to roll at all. And so that's a number we'll probably be looking for more feedback from the community on to try to get a better idea. Right now we're looking at what we see up there as something that seems reasonable. It should allow us, you know, sufficient frequency to make sure that we don't forget how to do this, but it's not so frequent that it's going to cost us a lot. Every time we roll the key, unless we change the key management procedures drastically, it does involve people traveling from far away. Like there's some people in this room that actually are the trusted community representatives that help us roll the key now. They have to come from a long way, you know, and really can't expect them to show up at the drop of a hat. That's not fair. Next slide. This is my last slide. So here's where we are. We really appreciate the recommendations out of SSAC, and now that they're final, we're going to look at them very carefully and look at the whole report. Thank you, Russ, and work party members. We're going to summarize some of the inputs we've received from the public consultation process. And we're going to also, before we run here, we're going to be excessively conservative, and with all the new GTLDs having entered the route, we are going to try to fully understand what impact these things may have on the overall stability and security of the DNS before we decide to also add in additional issues such as KSK rollover. So the last bullet is taking all those into account, we're going to look at the KSK rollover timeline and try to look at it as conservatively as possible. In other words, we're not going to roll the key this year. I can't say for sure, but I think we would not roll the key next year either. So that's about as far as I'm willing to predict. But we're going to take this very carefully at first. And once we've gotten all the information from this first exercise, we will then plan future key rollovers in a much more regular fashion, hopefully. Last slide, please. Talk to us. I'm here. Just grab me. You know, hit me over the head. Do whatever you have to do to convince me. You know what we have to do. Feel free to talk to any of those members as well as upper level company staff as well, just to understand what's going on with the root key rollover. There's an email address you can send it to. You can also just send it to richard.lam@icann.org. That's if you want a faster response, you can do that. I think with that. That's it. All right. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you, Rick. Right on time. Let me open the floor for questions. I see Warren.
So, Rick, somewhat of a loaded question. When you roll the key, even if you do it really carefully, do you think there is going to be some breakage, or do you think there will be no pain at all?
He did say Rick. Well, personally, no. I don't think there'd be any breakage. I don't know if you mean breakage with resolvers. Yes, breakage. I don't know if you're referring to the process that we run versus out in the real world. Out in the real world, yes, absolutely. Okay, we know that. But the idea is to try to come up with reasonable metrics of, again, that was a really good recommendation. How do we determine when to roll back or when we've broken things? So, okay.
Yeah, the issue of breakage is a hard one because it can mean very different things to different people. And this is one of the reasons why the SAC says, let's come up with a definition, whatever that may be.
I mean, I'm confident as far as the internal processes stuff, that a lot of the code actually already has 5011 support built in it. So,
other questions? I would have thought there'd be a lot in a room full of DNSSEC people. I guess everybody's confident that our root management partners are going to do it perfectly. Dan.
So, Dan York, I mean, I guess I'm not commenting, and maybe I'll speak for others, because at this point, what is there to comment on? We've all submitted comments into the process. We've seen the recommendations out of SSAC 063. And the response that Rick provided from ICANN is similarly lined up with that. So I think at this point, we're just looking forward to seeing what comes out of the next stage of this, which is really the analysis of what might break and the looking at that. So I don't think there's much else for us to comment on at this point, personally.
Let me just add one comment with respect to the ICANN and SSAC process. There's been a recent new addition to how the board is keeping track of recommendations that come from the SSAC to the board, and that is they are actually tracked. And there's a process put in place to follow the recommendations and see what whoever they're pointed at. In this case, most of the recommendations are pointed at staff. And so there is a much more clear-cut set of steps that should tie together the recommendations that have just been published literally a week ago, I think, and what happens next. And so we'll be able to see that. That's part of, I think, ICANN's initiative for making sure things are more visible than what they have been in the past. Okay, if that's it, thank you very much. And we'll move on to our next panel. And it is... Pum, pum, pum. Ah, Dan, structure of, no, it's not.
No, we're going to operational
readiness. Okay, yeah, so operational readiness. Yes, yeah, Stuart and Jason and Yashiro, please.
And we're starting out with Stuart. I just, we're having sound problems again.
Oh, my. Okay. is Yashiro here? I saw him. Oh, there he is. He was behind me. Okay, good. You have enough? Let me scoot down a little bit. You guys, a little more space here.
Perfect. I'm sorry, I'll have to do the slides.
Okay. Let me... I'm not sure how I'm going to do the timer here to keep people visible. Let me grab my iPad. Yeah, if you would, please.
Yeah.
Because the iPad is for the speakers. Time. Okay. All right. So are we set technically here?
Yes, we are.
Okay. Okay. So our panel... This panel is addressing what happens when you use DNSSEC in the real world. What are some of the experiences, the good things, the not so good things, this is wonderful, but. And our first presenter is Stuart Olmsted Wilcox talking about the CA registry. So please, let's just move right into your presentation.
Thank you. I'm Stu from CIRA, and I'm just going to talk about what we're doing in our last phase of basically deploying our full DNSSEC solution within the CA registry. And the choices we've made sort of relating to a lot of the discussion today, actually, as to how we've built our implementation. Perfect. So we've done this as a multi-phase project. First, we built the back-end sort of zone signing solution and signed our zone. So that was completed at the start of this year, and that's working well. The next phase was to actually, develop the DNSSEC support in our registry to allow our registrars to actually submit, DNSSEC information into the registry and then publish that in an automated fashion. So that work is almost done, and that's really what I'll summarize further on in the presentation. And then the final phase, which is what we're one of the things that we're talking to a lot of people about here and getting a lot of great information about or from other registries who have already sort of made to this phase is how we promote the adoption, how we promote signing within Canada and try and get some traction. Next slide. So this is the quick overview of the signer and validation process. Jacques actually presented this a couple times, I think. Basically, we have a redundant signing process that uses bind and open DNSSEC to sign and then has some level 2 validation that checks and makes sure that we get the expected result from both sets of signing before we publish. So this architecture was designed by Jacques and built by our operations team, and it really is working quite nicely so far. And we do have 80 signed domains that are maintained manually right now within the registry as well. So DNSSEC and the CA registry from a registrar perspective, the main and absolutely primary objective is keep it simple for registrars. And obviously that was a bit of a topic from one of our earlier panels. Keep going. So this is just a quick overview. Everyone here basically knows how this works, but for in our particular case, we do have a web interface, which we call our .ca manager, that allows registrars to submit transactions into our registry, and we also support EPP. So we're adding the capability to submit DNSSEC information into our registry via both mechanisms. Obviously, for EPP, we're following 5910, and the business rules in our web interface follow the same protocol, basically. And as we've sort of highlighted at the bottom, we're not trying to reinvent the wheel. So what we really tried to do, in keeping with our core objective, is stick with the standard, leverage what we've learned from the community, and then make it as easy as possible for registrars. Keep going. Top part's just summary of the DS versus key data records from the RFC. So our decision, based on all of what I've just discussed, was that we wouldn't make the or choice as described in the RFC. So we will support any of the interfaces. So a registrar can, for any given domain, can give us DS, they can give us DNS key, or they can give us both, and we'll accept them. And the reason for that really boils down to all of the discussion that we've heard today, and we talked to multiple different registries over time who have made the choice of key versus DS. And at the end of the day, it seemed that maybe the reason that the RFC was written that way wasn't as technical, potentially, as for other reasons, and it seemed that with some of the operational issues that people who have been signed for a good amount of time that have uncovered, this is maybe a better approach or a more, certainly for our registrars, an easier approach to allow them to integrate with us if they've integrated with other registries. Keep going. So these are just specific details on, you know, decisions we've made in our implementation. So obviously we're adhering to the schema defined in 5910. We've decided on a maximum of 6 DS records. We say and or DNS key because we'll accept both, but we'll obviously generate the DS. We accept all of the IANA specified algorithms for keys. We accept all 4 algorithms for DS digest. Excuse me. One thing that we did do in our current implementation is, if we're giving a, and when we generate the DS, I skipped one. we're using SHA-1 to generate the digest within our system. When we're given a DNS key and a DS, so the two together, we actually generate our own DS using the indicated algorithm for the digest type, and then we compare that with the given DS record just to validate, just as an extra level of validation to ensure that, or try and ensure at least that we think that the DS we were given actually is accurate, or at least what we think is accurate. that was actually a suggestion that Andrew Sullivan gave us a while ago, and it seems like a reasonable thing to do to begin with. The 2 optional elements that are defined within the RFC we're not supporting. Currently, we don't publish incremental updates of our zone. We publish once an hour, so the urgent attribute, our current infrastructure, we couldn't support. And we'll add the signed and unsigned status within our whois. this is just sort of giving a bit of extra information on our implementation regarding the DS or DNS key. I think the main things is that we're still adhering to the schema itself. So in a create, for example, we can't mix, we adhere to the schema, so you can't mix a DS or a DNS key in that actual transaction. But in an update, you could have given us a DS and then do an update and give us a secondary key, and we'll accept it, is really, really the difference here. Go ahead. So again, our next challenge, once we roll out the registry implementation, is to foster Canadian adoption, which has been everyone's challenge, I think, to this point. And so we've garnered a lot of information from the community. We certainly have started building a strategy around how we think we want to try and position DNSSEC for Canada. Certainly started talking to our registrars and trying to get their feedback on what they'd like to see from us. also talking to ISPs. And DNS operators within Canada, see what their state from a DNSSEC readiness is, as well as how we could help them to move that along as well. And so that's going to be our focus most of next year. And that's it. So from an implementation perspective, we do have a technical specification document we wrote for registrars to just explain our business rules and so forth. And that's all. Any questions?
Thank you, Stu.
Let's move on next to Jason Livingood from Comcast, and he's going to talk about negative trust anchors.
Great, thank you. You bring up the slide. So my name is Jason Livingood. I work for Comcast. We're a large ISP in the United States. Ironically enough, I'm kind of also watching a live broadcast here on my laptop. It's our company's 50th anniversary that we're celebrating today, so
Whoa.
Kind of a neat aside.
Congratulations.
Thanks. So diving right in, I thought that the focus of this would be about negative trust anchors, which is something that I'll explain in detail. But in essence, we operate one of the world's largest recursive DNS infrastructures, and we deployed DNSSEC a couple of years ago. And so this is all about one of the tools that we thought was pretty essential to supporting our rollout. Next slide, please. So DNSSEC validation, from our standpoint, is really great. It's wonderful, except in those occasions when it fails. And then it's sort of a problem. And what's interesting that we have observed is that sometimes when people think that this happens, they think that it's the ISP, in this case, blocking access to these sites. So we had a very interesting one, and we did a white paper about this a couple of years ago. NASA.gov, their signing failed, and there was a news report then claiming that we were blocking the website, and tons of people then blaming us on social media. And really, this wasn't us doing anything wrong. It was simply the signing got messed up. And we've noticed this repeatedly with domains that fail. Next slide, please. So a lot of people think, you know, serve fail, oh, you know, that's not good. They don't like DNSSEC. So, you know, sometimes things really get a little bit messed up operationally. And people tend to blame the validators. And it is very difficult to explain to your customers and to other people, the news media and so on, that this is really an authoritative issue. And that is out of the control of the internet service provider. And in many cases, people then say, well, if it doesn't resolve with these DNS servers that use DNSSEC validation, that then you should switch to, you know, pick your flavor of non-validating resolver out there. And people tend not to switch back after that. So they're really downgrading their security when they do that, just as a workaround. Next slide, please. So what's a negative trust anchor? You know, primarily today, validation would fail for one of two reasons. One would be an actual security issue. The other would be the second, which is an operational process or technical error. And at the moment, really, number two is the predominant one, where it is an operational signing problem, key rollover type of a thing. And so as a validator, you really, prior to negative trust anchors, had two choices. One, you could do nothing. And that could be problematic if either it's a domain that customers complain very loudly about, or if it is a major domain name that people are sending a lot of traffic to. So imagine Netflix.com, Google.com, you know, Akamai.net, and so on, something that is 10% or more of your traffic, that validation failing could be a real problem. So you could do nothing and allow that pain to be there and customers to be upset by it and call into your ISP, or you could turn off all validation for all domains, which seems, at least from my perspective, an overreaction. And so negative trust anchors means essentially that you are turning off validation for a single domain. And it's not like you're using a special signature saying that, you know, this is actually legitimate when it's not. You're really just turning off validation for that one domain. Next slide, please. And so we at Comcast have been using negative trust anchors since shortly after we launched DNSSEC validation, or right around the same time. When we do so, we note it on our DNS information website, which is there, dns.comcast.net. I should note we don't always do a negative trust anchor when we notice these failures, especially when it is what we call a repeat offender, where it's a domain or TLD that just can't seem to get it right. So we try to help out the first few times, but you know, after the 5th or 10th or 20th time, we sort of give up and say, well, they need to get better. And of course, we continue to strongly encourage more domains to sign, especially the big ones. And we strongly encourage domains that are signing their names to do so in a reliable fashion. Next slide. So we've taken this issue to the IETF, to the DNS Operations Working Group, And there's been a bit of debate about it. And so, you know, to put it mildly. And so one of the issues seemed to be, well, how long, if you documented that negative trust anchors exist, how long would you want that practice to be around? And most people sort of said, well, reasonably short period of time is how long an individual trust anchor should live. And what does that really mean? I think in practice, it tends to be one day or less in our network. But we're still having that discussion. And the other, which is probably the bigger issue, is the discussion about, is the fact that negative trust anchors exist a good thing in the long term, and should it be deprecated at some point in the future? And if it should be, what is the right time for that? Our perspective is that when DNSSEC deployment reaches some critical level of mass, that that would be an appropriate time. But we're not there yet, we don't believe. So next slide. So we definitely are hard at work. There's our studious cat. We are hard at work updating the draft. It's mostly based on my personal bandwidth. Because we had a little bit of pushback, I went and set out publishing two other drafts to try to get some lower-level agreement on two issues. One was basically who is responsible for DNSSEC mistakes, and the other is around recommendations of not switching resolvers when those failures occur. And next slide. So the first document really talks about who is responsible for authoritative DNS mistakes, and what it's intended to be is a reference that we can point customers and news reporters and other types of parties to really understand, okay, if there's a DNSSEC validation problem and it's for, say, operational, technical kinds of reasons, who's to blame for that? You know, who has the power to solve that problem? And what we try to explain, or what I try to explain, is that the power lies with the authoritative operator, the person that creates those records and puts them in the authoritative DNS. It's not an operator of a recursive server. And hopefully that will help. Next slide. And then the second one here is, so if you have a validation failure, suggesting to folks that they try to route around it by changing their resolvers is not a good thing, that they're really downgrading their security, and they should stick with resolvers that are validating, and they should wait for the authoritative party to resolve the issue or for someone to put a negative trust anchor in place. But it's not something that you should just sort of go and switch to something that is non-validating. You know, that's not a good thing from a security standpoint. Next slide, please. So that's it. That's the high-level overview of negative trust anchors, and happy to take any questions later on. But from our standpoint, we think it's a pretty essential tool for a recursive operator to have. And we've heard many other operators of recursive servers say that they would not deploy and turn on validation without this kind of mechanism as a sort of pressure relief valve in case a major domain failed or it was causing some real problems. And we think that's important, especially as we look forward to major domain names that represent traffic that's significant, on the order of 10%+ signing. That seems to me an essential tool for a network operator and DNS operator. Thank you.
Thank you, Jason. Next, we're going to hear from Yashiro, who's going to give us some of their experience in TTL lengths in JPNIC.
JPR.
Yeah, thank you. Sorry.
Hi, this is Yashiro from JPRS, which is a .jp registry. Today, I will explain our experiences that we changed the DSTTL in JP zone from 1 day to 2 hours. I explain about why, what was the background of these changes, and how we selected the 2 hours, and they explain about the conclusion. So next, please. So this is a background. So for using DNSSEC, there is a very big concern for the registrant and ISPs. So if DNS name resolution will fail, I'm sorry. Yeah, if DNSSEC operation failed, then the DNS name resolution will fail. And this is very big impact to the end users. And this mistake is usually happened with a mismatch of DS in parent zone with DNS key in child zone. And if this situation happens, then urgent recovery between parent and child zone administrators are required. But this typically requests registrant, registrar, and registry cooperation. And even though urgent recovery had done, but the influence of the name resolution failure will remain until DS cache invalidators being expired. So registrant and ISP wants to shorten the duration. This is the background. So next, please. So there are two possible countermeasures for this failure. One is a flush failed domains cache invalidators. But this is a very ad hoc solution, and how to reach each validator's operators, because there are hundreds of thousands of ISPs in the world. So Comcast is not the only one validator operator. So we have to reach many operators. So this is almost impossible. The second countermeasure is shorten DSDTL in parent zone. So this could be an effective solution. But the fact is the moderate value for DSDTL is not shared yet. This solution is possible because this is done by the registry or zone operators. So this is on the this is based on the decision of the zone administrator. Next, please. So before we changed the DSDTL, we measured our DNS behaviors. So we investigated two JPDNS servers. We have seven DNS servers, but two of them are obtaining DNS query log. So we looked for the query of those two servers. We also viewing DSC graph. And from the DSC graph, monitoring six out of seven DNS servers with DSC graph, and DSC graph shows the same number with the two servers. So we thought that investigation of only two servers will obtain whole behavior of our DNS servers. So the result of our analysis was that DS queries per whole DNS queries is about 3.5%. So the reason why DS queries is so many is another story, so I do not explain here, but my colleague made some consideration about it. So if you have any interest, please refer to the URL here. And the DS queries which has a DS registration, the ratio of the existing DS query and the whole DS queries is about 0.08%. So only a very few DS queries are a real DS query which has a DS registration. So other DS queries are only for check if that domain name has a DS or not. So this graph shows the DS query ratio and existing DS query ratio. The left-hand side scale shows the DS query ratio, and the right-hand side scale shows the existing DS ratio. So the DS existing DS query is very, very, very low. So next, please. So I will explain about how we decided the moderate DSTTR. We use a three-step analysis. The first one is consider... next, please. Next slide, please. First one was thinking about similarity with NCache TTL. So if so the DSTTL can be considered as a duration of inference when name resolution failure occurs. And NCache TTL is also the duration of status when query name did not expect, exist. So that there are similarity between DS and NCache regarding name resolution failure. And for the NCache TTL, it is recommended, its value is recommended from 1 hour to 3 hours. This is based on RFC 23.8. So DSTTL would also be effective if within the range from 1 to 3 hours. Next, please. So we calculated, estimated the change of the DS queries if we change the TTL, DSTTL. So top one is the result of our analysis, log analysis. So as I said, the DS query ratio is 3.5 and existing DS query ratio is 0.08. So if the DSTTL changed to 3 hours, DS query ratio will not change because the existing DS query is very small portion. But the existing DS query ratio will be increased to 0.6. It is about multiplied 8 times. And if DSTTL changes to 2 hours, existing DS query ratio will be 0.9%. And if we change to 1 hour, existing DS query ratio will be increased to 1.8%. So next, please. So this graph shows the how the existing DS query ratio changes. Okay, next, please. So finally, we considered three conditions. How which value is most suitable for current.jp. So the three conditions are small, if how small impact to the current JP DNS, and how it is enough to scale the shortening of DSTTL. And if the existing DS queries will not increase if DS and validators are increased. So that our decision was 2 hours because it is the most moderated value for these conditions. So next, please. So this is conclusion. We decided to shorten DSTTL from 1 day to 2 hours. So this value is just works for current JP DNS, and this value will be changed in the future if we find much more suitable value. And this event was happened on this month, last Sunday, 17th. So we changed this about 3 days before, but after change. I analysis the log and find that the existing DS ratio is a little bit increasing, but the total DS query ratio is not changed so much as expected. So please give your comments based on your experience if you change or if you are considering to change the DSTTL, and I'd like to share it as a best current practice for especially for TLDs. Thank you.
Thank you.
So we've had some really good presentations here about real-world experience and issues. And I'd like to open the floor for questions or comments from folks. Warren.
So Warren Kamari, Google. Question and comment for Jason. So Google DNS now does validation. We were not doing validation when the NASA.gov stuff happened, and we actually noticed a fair uptick in the number of people using our services, because as soon as NASA.gov happened, a bunch of people sent, you know, posts on various things like /dot saying, simply change your resolver to 8888, and suddenly everything works. Now we're doing validation, but I don't think we could possibly have turned it on without some sort of NTA-type technique in place. There are, however, a number of people who say that negative trust anchors are harmful because it doesn't create an incentive for the people running auth servers to actually do this stuff correctly, and concerns about opening yourself up to legal liability because if it is a real hijack, you're telling people it's all okay. Do you have any comments on that?
Sure. Generally speaking, we have only been putting negative trust anchors in place when the administrator of the domain, the authoritative owner, contacts us and says, yeah, we messed up. Can you please do something here? Or where we notice it and then we reach out to them and they confirm, oh, yes, it was an operational issue. So it's definitely not automatic, because then, you know, it could be that very risk that you mentioned, which is it a security problem for real or an operational issue? So I think that addresses, you know, that part. You know, generally, you know, are they harmful? You know, I think it's better to have DNSSEC validation than not. And this is, in my opinion, one of the ways that you get to more validation happening.
Well, I have one comment, since I don't see any from the audience at this point, and that is Jason indicated that the negative trust anchor idea is not necessarily widely accepted throughout the IATF and the standards world. And this is not a new problem. In fact, in the time frame between 2065 and the 4000 series of specs, there were at least two major efforts to put in to the specs themselves this capability, and the working group rejected them very soundly. So it's been an issue that's been raised before and has not been accepted through the IETF. So it's a problem that is trying to do a balancing act between operations and sort of the security perfection idea.
Yeah, and I think it's indicative or emblematic of a larger tension that you see from time to time at the IETF, which is you have a protocol developed and sort of a purist view of how to carry out that and implement it. And then you have a very different set of people whose job is to deploy and make things work at scale, not at small scale, at very, very large internet scale. And that's where guys like, you know, me and Warren and other people come in. And there are simply things that you learn as a result that you have to adapt to. And you know, I know I and many other people, and Warren and others, are trying to help the IETF become more open to operators participating and sharing their views about, you know, actually doing these things. And the reality is that, you know, both of these communities, not only do they, you know, cross over quite a bit, but they need each other. A great protocol is nothing if it's not deployed. And so in the case of DNS security, you know, I think it certainly holds true.
Right.
This is also to Jason Livingood about negative trust anchors. I actually like the idea. I think it's necessary, and it ties into something a little bit, I think, wider. There's been some discussions within the IETF operations, DNS operations group, about the ability to remotely do something about, basically to flush a cache, if that makes any sense. Now, how that will look like in the future, I have no idea, but I can tell you that being on the wrong end of things once in a while, we really would like to have a mechanism in order to flush a cache. Now, I know that negative trust anchors is not the exact same thing, but it ties into that same discussion about the imbalance between those who make a mistake, those who consume it, and the man in the middle who gets all the blame. Thanks.
Yeah, no, I think cache flushing mechanisms are important. I know Warren has a draft there in the ITF, and that's a discussion that's starting. What you typically see is you get these ad hoc requests via some random mailing list. You know, maybe it's OARC, maybe it's DNSSOP, maybe it's NANOG or whatever. And, you know, I think one of the recent ones, maybe it was someone from the New York Times. So they needed a cache flush, and you get these requests via email, and how do you validate, is this really the domain administrator or not? Should you do this? And it would be nice to just have that work in a somewhat more distributed and automatic fashion. And I think that's one of the tools that you want in the tool set here.
Dan, I was just going to comment that I think, Jason, your comments are spot on about the deployability of protocols versus that. And I would encourage people here and remote, this is a critical issue to get more operators and more people who are using these protocols to participate in the IETF in some form, even if it is purely just to go and read the documents and do that. And in fact, I'll be talking about that in a moment when I'm up here, but I just want to emphasize that point. I think it is key to get people giving feedback on this.
Yeah, Warren again. So if there's no NTA RFC, one of two things will happen. A, people won't be able to deploy DNSSEC because there's a huge cost to enabling it. Or B, people will continue to do NTA, but just not in a standard way. And neither of these are good outcomes for DNSSEC deployment.
Yeah, I agree. And I think the key to understanding this is validators will do this sort of thing. Do you want it documented so people understand what it is and how it works and what the practices are around it, and some level of standardization and a discussion about it out in the open? Or do we all wish to pretend doesn't exist, and if we don't talk about it, that it doesn't really exist? And I don't think that's too realistic. And I think generally, in sort of the post-Snowden world, so to speak, the ITF meeting a couple of weeks ago in Vancouver talked about this security more generally, at the technical plenary. And I think the ITF and many other technical groups in general are talking about how to increase the level of security on the internet. And certainly things like TLS for website access is one mechanism. I think DNSSEC is another facet of that, sort of generally increasing the security of the internet. And I hope that, when we start to see, after this meeting, a little bit more momentum around DNSSEC, particularly signing big names, and that can be something that can help along that long security road.
Erwin, go ahead.
Erwin Lansing.dk. Not sure how many of you were in my talk on Monday, but that was actually my point at the end, and to be a bit provocative about deployability and offer people that work on standards that we got some people, especially for DNS, DNSSEC security, interested in FreeBSD. We want to get it, help you get it implemented at the OS level and get it deployed and get some real-world experience with that.
Well, I think we really have reached the end of our time for this panel, and let's thank our panelists very much for their presentations.
Yeah, just to know what we should do with the question in the chat.
Okay, I think
it's like who was after.
So I have the unenviable task of trying to do about a half hour's worth of presentation in about 15 minutes, along with wrapping this up. And there was a question in the chat room that we'll raise to Jason. Jason, if you're...
No, it was Stuart.
It was to Stuart. Yeah. Okay.
And or Roy Aarons.
All right.
His name is Brett, and he says he knows Roy, so I don't know.
So, okay, so we'll raise that question to you guys that's there. Okay, so... I am going to finish up here with a little bit of a piece about Dane and what happened at the IETF, And for those who are remote, the slides are available there, and so we'll be able to go through this. Where do I click?
You can't do it.
Oh, I can't do it. All right. Okay. So next, just to basically remember what we're looking at here, when we talk about DANE and the DANE protocol, I guess I should ask this: how many of you here are familiar with DANE? All right. So I'm talking to a lot of folks who already know this. All right, so for those who are remote, you can see this, and we'll just kind of walk through this. So if you look at the slides, this is what we see in an SSL interaction. We have an HTTPS, nice little green lock, goes go on. And the question is, does this have the correct certificate? Let's go on. So the problem can be that a firewall or an attacker, somebody else can get in the middle of that and re-encrypt it with TLS, and so you wind up with seeing the correct lock. So let's go on. A DANE-equipped web browser or other device, other application, would be able to detect that this had happened and be able to alert the application or web browser that there was a problem and that it was not the correct certificate. And so let's go next. So this is what we're talking about protecting. DANE is defined in RFC 6698, and it asks this question of how do you know that the SSL certificate you're using is the correct one? And go ahead, next. So one of the interesting things is that DANE is a container for a TLS certificate or a public key of it, a fingerprint of that certificate, and that's a key point. That is what DANE does, is it specifies a new record, RFC 6698, it's the TLSA record. There are some other proposals that will have variations on that, but it's the same idea. It's a record, a DNS record, that is a holder of a TLS certificate. And as I show on the slide, there's four different modes of it. One is where you say that it is this specific certificate, which is the one of the modes is there. One, you can say, I will only accept certificates that are issued by a specific certificate authority. Okay. There's also a mechanism where you can say, this is the specific certificate I want, and this is the specific certificate, which may not be signed by a CA, a certificate authority. It may be a self-signed certificate. So DANE provides this kind of flexibility to let us go and have to create a layer of trust, a trust layer, if you will, for TLS and SSL certificates and the usage of that. Go on to the next. Now, DANE is, you know, we talk a lot about it in context of web browsers because it's an obvious use for it, but what we're actually seeing is a lot of interest in using it in other places. The folks who are using who have done the postfix email server have implemented DANE inside of that so they can use it to determine are they connecting to the correct mail server to go and deliver email. I just over the past week or so, a good number of the XMPP community have gone out and implemented DNSSEC in their Jabber servers. So the Jabber servers are now able to authenticate using DNSSEC, not authenticate, to validate that they are connecting to the correct server on the other end when they are going and delivering XMPP messages. There's some folks working on it within the VoIP space to see how can they use this when you need to go and deploy certificates out to thousands of phones or applications. How can you go and do that? Next, please. So we've got a number of different uses. There's some links up here around a number of the drafts that are out there around using DANE with email. There's a good draft called DANE Operational Guidance, which Wes Hardiger, who many of us know, worked on with a gentleman named Victor Duchovny, who's behind the postfix email server. And basically what he did was while he was implementing DANE in postfix, he wrote down what was going on as he was going through this and came up with this draft, which he and Wes would like to make more generic. So they're looking for experience from people implementing DANE where they talk about this, but they're trying to capture that kind of information there. And then there's some other ones. Paul Wouters wrote a couple around using it with PGP and with OTR IM. Next, please. So there's a number of places that are there. I've got some pointers here again. We maintain a page at Deploy 360 around the DANE with DANE overview. There's a nice IETF journal article with it, and there's the RFCs. Next, please. So there's also some new tools that are out there. We are maintaining a couple lists of that. The DNSSEC tools project has one as well. Next slide, I think. Okay, so Okay. This is also a mailing list. I was going to bring this up later, so I guess I misarranged my slides. But anyway, this is a list you all are invited to join. A number of us are here where we're looking at how do we coordinate advocacy really around promotion of DNSSEC and DANE activities. I would also say, I guess it's going to come up on my ITS slides in a minute. There is something new with DANE that I'll talk about in a moment. So that's the quick overview of DANE. I want to move into ITF. Last 2 weeks ago was ITF 88 in Vancouver. Next slide, please. And there were about 1,200 participants from 54 countries that were there. There was a huge amount of focus on security. Next, please. On the DNS side, there were really three pockets of activity. One was DNSOP, the working group. And actually, on a quick note, how many of you in this room were there? Yeah, look at all the hands. Okay, a number of the folks are here in this room. So there was also a side meeting on the DANE protocol that again found a whole bunch of us up in a room on the top floor of the hotel talking about DANE and things. And then there was also another group called the DNSSD extensions, which is looking at using multicast DNS and DNS-based service discovery and using that, extending it beyond a local LAN. And that, just as a reference, that's like Bonjour and the stuff that you use for connecting on the local network, seeing the number of Apple devices that we have around, all those things that let you rapidly find a printer or something like that, or another machine. This whole thing is how do you take that and move it beyond a local network into a multi-network environment, and how do I find the printer in my mother's house or something like that? How do I do that securely? And there are people looking at how would we do something with DNSSEC? What role would it play in there to help securely ensure we connect between that? But that was I mentioned it purely because there was a momentary in there. But let's go on to the next slide, please. In DNSOP, In DNSOP, there was a lot of discussion, and as Warren will attest, there was a whole lengthy discussion around this whole issue of the automating of the transmission of records that we just talked about earlier, that Warren did, about the CDS, CDNS key. It's great. The new draft that was talked about earlier came up out of the discussion here to kind of merge all this together and make a little bit more sense. There was also, following on Yoshiro's talk, there was some discussion there on DS queries and pieces. And then also there's a couple of drafts going on that, again, Paul Wooters has been focusing on around increasing the efficiency of DNSSEC queries, and specifically some areas around how can we basically keep TCP connections open? How can we keep some of the different connections to allow us to do more queries in a single connection? So some very interesting work going on there to make it more efficient. Next, please. And so this is all sort of work that's happening in there. You can see here a link on the slides to where you can get the agenda and the documents that came out of there for this IETF 88. There's also another document I'll mention from Wes Hardiger, which is talking about DNSSEC roadblock avoidance. And basically, he was trying to capture a good number of insights, lessons learned about where there are roadblocks within the DNSSEC structure that need to be avoided. So next slide, please. There was a side meeting that we had about DANE where a number of us looked at it. Some of the key points that came out of there was really as a focus area, we need to look at how can we get more TLSA records deployed. One of the reasons around this was that one of the pushbacks we've had from browser vendors is they don't want to implement it because it will potentially impact speed. But we learned in that meeting, certainly, that browser vendors are looking at how many actual DANE records are out there. And seeing not a lot of them, they're sort of saying, why should we bother with this? So the more generation of TLSA records we can get, the better we make our case with the browser vendors and others. Two quick drafts to mention. There was one that Oliver Goodmanson's working on around terminology, which is something that's critical. And then also, we had a discussion. The folks at NIST have come out with a test tool that lets you test the validity of DANE certificates. And that's what's up here, and some more publicity around that will be forthcoming. So next, please. Finally, there was, as mentioned by Jason a few minutes ago, there was a very strong focus on strengthening the internet around what we can do to harden it against large-scale pervasive surveillance. There was a technical plenary. If you haven't seen it, I would encourage you to go take a look. It's a video that's up there, and that page, itf.org/live/ITF88, has a link to the video as well as a link to other materials that are there as well. Next, please. And it was, again, more summary of information you can get out of the links. Next, please. The other piece I would mention, again, if you are not familiar with working with the IETF, I would encourage people to go to this IETF.org/newcomers. There's a particular group, IPv6 Ops and DNS Ops, that are ones that could really use some operator and assistance in us. So join the mailing list, read the drafts, help provide comments. It would be very helpful for us. And that, I think, is it. So with that, let's shift rapidly. I'm not going to take questions because we are out of time, but I'll be here to take some more questions. We're going to shift to the wrap-up slides that we have. And for that, we actually have no time, so Russ's clock doesn't even get to get set. So we're going to wrap this up by saying to people who are either here in the room or who are remote, things we would encourage you to do is we would encourage TLD operators and registries to sign your TLD, accept the DS records, work with the registrars, help. Another aspect is help with statistics. You've seen some charts that we've had up here about deployment. We'd like to work with more TLD registries around how we can help provide more of these. If we go on to the next slide. Do you mind?
Zone operators. Yeah, sign your zone. And one of the other things that I want to add that from the earlier presentation about enterprises, we're all part of an enterprise in one way or another. Look at implementing DNSSEC throughout your enterprise. Make use of it at the enterprise level, as well as signing your zones and checking the validation. Actually, go forth at the enterprise level and look at using applications like Bloodhound and other capabilities that make use of the validation, make use of DNSSEC.
And we want service providers, network service providers and ISPs who are out there, please let's deploy DNSSEC validating DNS resolvers, because that's another incredible part that we need to make this happen. And of course, signing your own zones is important. And again, we want people to be promoting the DANE protocol. Really help us drive that, because it's one of those areas that is new that helps provide a solid reason why we can look at DNSSEC being used and provide some true value there.
Websites, again, sign your zones. But another important area is put in TLSA records. Actually, and that itself promotes and will promote the browsers being more likely to support DANE as a protocol. So deploy TLSA records in sites and zones that you control. Make use of it yourself.
Yeah, so everyone, we can say here, use DNSSEC yourself. We've got a number of different tools. Share your lessons learned. Participate in these workshops. And I will say as well, not only do we thank everybody who is here, but we will be having another one of these in our next session in Singapore. We'll be doing another one of these. We're always looking for new case studies, new presentations, new tools. So for those of you who have been sitting here listening today, either in this room or remotely, and you've got ideas, we would love to hear from you. There will be a call for presentations coming out soon, and we'll start to be planning that next event. And we're always open to ideas if you have them. And Julie, I think...
And we make no promises that we won't ask you to compress your presentations, because everybody today did so and did so very well. Thank you, everyone who participated and presented.
And with that, we'd like to say thank you to everybody who's been here this entire time. We put up a couple websites here, www.dnssec-deployment.org, www.internetsociety.org/deploy360. We're missing the .org in there, I notice. And www.dnssec-tools.org as well. Yeah, that one won't. Hey, is there a .internet society new GTLD yet?
Oh,
no.
Dotless domain.
All right, dotless domain. Here we go, something on that. Well, anyway, yeah. Those in this room will get that, actually, but never. Anyway, so we want to thank you all, because there is a whole lot of work, too, in the program committee. And I think there's still a few members who are here. Who's on the program committee that's still here? I see Jacques. Okay, Yoshiro. Okay. All right, so I'd just like to say, there's a lot of work that's involved with this. A lot of people have been part of this to make it happen. And so I'd like to give a round of thanks for all of those folks, too. And I have to say a final thing, too, which is we definitely need to give a round of thanks to Julie. Without her, I could tell you, without her, all of this would not happen as seamlessly as it does. Well, all of those things, right? She's what makes this happen. Even when there are seams, it still all works through and it all goes on. So thank you very much. All right, thank you, everyone, and thanks, let's go out and make DNSSEC happen.